Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome now Michael McGarrity. He is the author of the Kevin Kearney series of books, the latest of which is Dead or Alive, and he will be at Garcia Street Books on Saturday, January 10th, from 2:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's always a pleasure to see you again and be here.
Thank you. So let's talk for a moment about our hero, Kevin Kearney. You've written, what, 12 Kevin Kearney books now?
This is the 12th, yeah. Dead or Alive is the 12th.
And so how did you, who is this guy?
Well, he's kind of evolving as the series grows. What I wanted to do with him is create a character that didn't carry a lot of baggage, wasn't in recovery, wasn't a loose cannon, which tends to be, I think, a real crutch for a lot of popular fiction writers. They'll create a protagonist who has all kinds of emotional baggage as a way to try to make him or her interesting. And I found that to be kind of cliche. As a person who loves to read, I found those characters very cliche. And I thought to myself, it really takes the burden off the writer to create a fully drawn character. Instead, you can just have this person who's quirky or eccentric or is suffering from some sort of malaise or is in recovery or grieving. And it's kind of a crutch.
And it's also kind of the human condition, too. Everybody's got some messed up.
Yeah, there's nothing perfect about my protagonist. He's a guy who's carrying some issues around with him. But he's like most of us insofar as he is fully functional. He does a job and is in a career that he loves. He's striving to reach some sort of relationship goals, both professionally and personally. And so the series is just sort of an evolution of this guy's life as he progresses and begins to achieve some of the goals that for a long time he thought were inaccessible to him.
So when you started writing the Kevin Kearney books, how old was Kevin and what was he doing?
I think I've got him right now pretty much somewhere in his 50s.
Right.
So he was, when we started out, he was in his 40s. And living on his own, recovering from a serious gunshot wound that occurred in the line of duty. And
is that the gunshot wound to the gut that is still plaguing him in this 12th novel?
Yeah, sure. And will always plague him.
Right.
Will always plague him. And was kind of floating out there, outside of his profession, no longer serving as an officer, working as a caretaker on a spread in the Galisteo Basin, alone, all on his own, no significant relationships going on. And that's where we find him. We find him in his 40s in that kind of middle age transition, if you will. You can call it a crisis if you want to. And that's where we pick up his life, and from there he progresses through these 12 novels to the point now that he's married. He's happily married. He's deeply in love with the woman he's married to. He's a father of a young 4-year-old boy. He's just simply recently retired from his position as chief of the Santa Fe Police Department, which was a job that he aspired to for many years. And so you see a transition and a progression in this man's life. He's not perfect, but I think he's
awful cool, though, I have to say. I mean, when I have to think about what his flaws are, it's hard to find them.
Well, he hides them well.
He or you?
Yeah, well, both of us, perhaps. But he is cool, and a lot of people tell me that they're really drawn to him for that reason. He's got kind of an interesting combination of cowboy and cop, which I think appeals to both men and women. You know, there's that romantic image of a fiercely independent yet totally morally upright guy out there in the world who functions pretty much within the rules, except he doesn't always, as you know.
Right.
You know.
Now, did he actually grow up on a ranch?
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you start with Tularosa, which is the debut novel, which came out in 1996, the backstory there lets you know that, as a matter of fact, the ranch that he was born and raised on was taken over by the government when White Sands Missile Range expanded. And so his family lost the ranch while he was still a child, and he was forced to live on a neighboring ranch where his father worked outside of the missile range. And so one of his dreams and aspirations had always been to return to ranching, to make up for that loss of the ranch to the family. And he even achieves that goal in the series in a smaller way, but still, you know, has a ranch outside of Santa Fe after a very surprising and large bequest comes his way from a source that he never thought he'd ever consider getting any money from.
It's interesting to read these books. I think this is probably the third. You write just about one of these Kevin Kearney books per year. You've been doing it since 96, and it's just barely 2009, and we're on the 12th one. And there's, you always, as an author, have a choice of how much of the backstory to fill in and how much you just leave it to the reader to either guess or actually go back to the earlier novels. For example, he's got a son who is half Apache, who has a different last name than he does. And this book, in this book, he plays a major role, but we don't really, we're not really told the story. What is his son's story?
It was kind of a risky business thing on my part. He has a grown-up son that he's just still in the process of getting to know, because for years he didn't know this person's existence at all. He had a liaison when he was at university in Las Cruces, New Mexico State University. He had a girlfriend and a love affair with her, and she happened to be a full Mescalero Apache. And on her own, without telling him, before he left to get his ROTC commission and ship out to Vietnam towards the end of the war, she got pregnant and had his child, and chose to never tell him, and chose to raise her son alone back at the Mescalero Reservation. So in an earlier book called The Judas Judge, Kearney's investigating some crimes down in the Tularosa Basin area, which abuts the Mescalero Apache Reservation, and comes upon this tribal officer by the name of Clayton Istey, and as the story unfolds, finds out indeed that this is his son.
Now, how does he, just out of curiosity, does he recognize gestures or facial expressions? Or
actually, it's his friend that's with him, and it points out the striking physical similarities to Kearney, right? And Kearney just dismisses it, right, initially. But after having repeated contacts with this young man, he comes to realize that indeed he may be this officer's son, father rather, and goes and finds his former college sweetheart, who's a chief nurse at the hospital on the reservation, and confronts her about it and learns, yes, indeed, he is this young man's father.
And like Jesus, he went into his father's profession.
Without even knowing it.
Exactly. We're talking to Michael McGarrity. His latest book is called Dead or Alive. And so Kevin Kearney, let's go to the book that we're in now. Kevin Kearney and his son, Clayton, find themselves involved in a manhunt for a really evil villain.
Yeah.
What's the inspiration for this villain character?
You know, the inspiration for the start of the book was really a simple one. It wasn't to have this guy be that, as bad as he turned out to be. It was to do something with the fact that one of the standing jokes in New Mexico, in the jail and correctional system, is that with almost regularity, some goofball lets a bad guy out of the slammer or out of the county lockup on a snafu, right? And, I mean, I cannot think of a time where it hasn't happened every 6 months in the last year.
So somebody is named Juan Garcia,
right,
and there's another Juan Garcia, and they let the wrong one out.
Right, or they didn't get the paperwork that said, no, don't let this guy out of jail because they say they didn't get the paperwork to let this guy out of jail because we've got a warrant for his arrest from another jurisdiction. Or nobody checked to see if there had any ones and warrants for the guy. And so he was just booked and then released. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that a mistake can be made. And so that was really the kickoff for me for the story, was to have some guy that looks like he's not all that dangerous, not all that violent, just a basic bad guy get let out of jail for a goof-up on the part of the system.
And he's not really let out of jail. He's transferred to a minimum security jail.
Yeah, he's going to be transferred to a minimum security prison. But that allows him the opportunity to effect an escape. What happens with him is, as the story progresses, he begins to realize that killing people is something that he really enjoys doing. And so what we see is a study in psychopathology, in as much as through circumstance, this person finally begins to realize that he's a natural-born killer. And that's something that gives him great pleasure. And so there's this accelerating arc, if you will, throughout the story as his crimes become more and more vicious and more absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, he doesn't seem quite so bad in the beginning.
No.
And he spares people's lives sort of at the, you know, when he didn't have to. But then he turns into, what is the nature of that? I mean, did you look at the psychopathology of existing real-life criminals?
There's usually an arc in criminality. There's usually a period of, if you will, transformation. In an earlier book, in Hermit's Peak, I kind of dealt with the same process when I wrote about a young killer who was just starting out as a sexual predator. And I did that particular story because I didn't want to just do another sexual predator novel. In fact, I wanted to show the evolution into the criminality. And in Dead or Alive, I do the same thing, only I've broadened the canvas. And instead of making the villain a sexual predator, I've just simply made him a predator.
Right.
You know, in the nastiest, vile, most vile sense.
I remember having the director of the Santa Fe Rape Crisis Center on the air once, and she said something which was very scary to me, which is that you've got to get perpetrators into, if they're going to be ever be helped, you have to get them into therapy, into the system, before that sense of enjoyment really takes hold.
It's true. It's not only a sense of enjoyment, it's a sense of fulfillment. It's a way of creating meaning in these individuals' lives where they have no other meaning. I mean, they're operating primarily on instinct. They're not operating with any kind of insight at all other than that which is self-gratifying. And so that's why they're predators, is because they have no remorse, they have no guilt. And it goes beyond simple pathology and really gets into, you know, the totally crazy stuff.
So the totally crazy stuff is beyond pathology?
I think so, yeah. I mean, sure, you can codify it. You know, you can sit down with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association and find a little place where you can put them. But these people are basically so bad that I think they defy categorization. I've had, you know, like 25 years experience in criminal justice, mostly here in Santa Fe before I started writing. And I spent time working in prisons. I spent time with the corrections department. I worked with offenders coming out of the system. I worked in law enforcement, worked with juvenile justice, blah, blah, blah. You know, I covered just about the whole scene. There were people that I met in drug treatment programs, in the SLAM, when I was on the street as a police officer, that I, in my heart, totally believe should never, ever, ever be let out of jail.
Right.
Ever.
And a tiny minority, I would imagine.
Yeah, of course a tiny minority, but they can do so much damage.
Right.
You know, and putting them into the criminal justice system doesn't rehabilitate them, it only makes them worse.
Right.
And so they are predators in the true sense of the word, and they're dangerous people. And some of them are totally charming. Some of them are facile and believable in so many different ways, and they're just incredibly dangerous people.
So are they, I mean, would you say that this character, Craig Larson, the evil villain in your novel, Dead or Alive, by the way, we're talking to Michael McGarrity, is a realistic character? I mean, are there people like this?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. And he's sort of like at the top of the food chain when it comes to villains, if you will. But there are people who kill without remorse. There are people who kill without a sense of guilt. There are people who kill and destroy and hurt and maim for the pleasure that it brings. In some cases, the pathology can be traced all the way back to early childhood.
Of having people do remorseless things to them.
You know, it can be something simple and yet grotesque, like torturing an animal when you're a young person, or setting a fire, or having no regard for other people's property. I mean, it can start at a very early age. Now,
but what else? I mean, they must also be, in large part, people who were themselves abused in one way or another. Is that not the case?
That's a prevailing attitude. It always gets back to the family, socioeconomic status, poverty, things done to a child that are abusive, neglectful, or destructive, or harmful. But there's also some theory out there that some of the stuff could just be simply how the brain malfunctions, and that there are people whose synapses just don't work the right way, and they don't connect, and they're not wired in a way that's conducive to normal socialization.
Or, I would imagine, some combination of both.
Could be a combination of both.
So this character has a twin brother who looks exactly like him, but something happened in the birth to where the twin brother is not very bright, and the criminal, Craig Larson, is sort of the evil genius. And the brother is quite sweet. And I was thinking, I wondered why it was the smart one who was the villain and the dumb one who was the nice guy.
In some cultures, when someone suffers from mental retardation, they're not ostracized. They're called the innocents, innocentes. My experience working with people who suffer from developmental disability or have some sort of impairment in intellectual function is that they are not, by nature, people who are going to do bad things. What will happen to them, even if they're mentally ill and not hostile or aggressive, is they may break a law here or there. They may, for example, break into a building to get warm because they're hungry and cold. They'll get into the criminal justice system because of violations like that, that are more like misdemeanors. They might get caught shoplifting because they're hungry. But they're not the kind of people that are going to involve themselves in really felonious acts. They're not going to go out there and hurt, maim, kill, steal, rob, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, your point of view, I think, is backwards from reality. That most criminals are of average intelligence or better.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, sure. They may not test well because of limited educational opportunities, but it comes in their functional level. They function normally.
So I found myself at the beginning of the book, and I've noticed this in almost every book where there is a villain on the run that I've ever read, that at least at some point I find myself rooting for the fugitive, saying, boy, I hope they get away. Because no matter what they've done, it can't be as bad as going into the system. But with this guy, at a certain point, all you can hope is that he gets caught.
Yeah.
But have you noticed that psychology in yourself or in others of rooting for the fugitive, even if he's a criminal?
Yeah, if the character is well enough drawn, he or she's going to have some redeeming qualities, some personality traits that are going to make you lean in that direction, that are going to make you say, this is a person who can be redeemed. You know, this is a person who can be salvaged. You know, if only that could happen, that would be great. So I understand that, but this guy is not salvageable. Craig Larson is not salvageable.
It's not even just that you think he's salvageable. It's that you identify with him, and if you were on the run, you wouldn't want to get caught either.
Yeah. I think it'd be hard to identify with this guy on that level.
Well, with this one, yeah. After a while,
right.
He's just so bad.
Yeah, he's so bad, you just want to see him caught.
Now, this is another thing. I was talking to an acquaintance yesterday who is a great reader of mysteries and thrillers, and I've noticed that there's something going on, and she's noticed the same thing, which is more villains who are purely evil. I noticed that during the Santa Fe Film Festival, we had a villain in one of the movies about which we did an interview who was just bad, so bad. There was nothing redeeming about him. And I thought, what is this? We were talking, what is this about? Is this the political time we're living in where things like waterboarding and torture and extradition are politically condoned, that more evil is surfacing in literature?
It's a great question. I didn't really start out, as I said earlier, to make this guy turn into what he morphed into over the course of the book. So I wasn't deliberately saying, let me create a villain who is, you know, purely bad.
Did I say extradition? I meant extreme rendition. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I understood what you meant. So, it may be that your point about society having sort of collapsed a little bit when it comes to civil liberties, when it comes to the protection of people's rights, when it comes to feelings and apprehensions that we have about the outgoing administration, if you will, when it comes to questions of what the CIA has been doing and what Guantanamo stands for and what's been happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's laid the psychic groundwork, if you will, for villains of this caliber. It could well be that's part of the subconscious mindset that is affecting people who are writing and the storytellers out there, whether they're making it through movies or television or novels.
Yeah, I wonder, because we have other kinds of villains whom we've seen, you know, probably more often, who have something positive going for them, so mm-hmm. that the character becomes complicated, as we see heroes who have some not-so-nice qualities. And the interaction of that makes for a different kind of psychological complexity.
It does. If you look historically to what's happened over the last 40 years in terms of mystery novels and action movies and films that are crime dramas, you'll see that there has been an acceleration of the black and white division between the good guys and the bad guys. You take an old movie like Bullet with Steve McQueen, and Robert Vaughn sort of plays his nemesis in Bullet. It not only has one of the greatest car chase scenes ever put on film, but it is a movie that is devoid of any profanity until one key point when there's a confrontation between Robert Vaughn and Steve McQueen, and McQueen says BS, you know, but says the word. And if you watch that movie, it has an enormous impact, right? Because up until that point, people aren't saying F this, F that. They're not, you know, cursing and calling each other by all the profanity that's so prevalent in the movies today. And it works. The same thing, I think, is true with character development. If you take a look at some of the earlier film noir things with, like, Robert Mitchum, or take a classic like Cape Fear, and then the remake, and look at it, you'll see that what's happened at, over the last 40 or 50 years is the character development has become that convoluted type of thing, where it's no longer black and white. You know, Humphrey Bogart was always Humphrey Bogart, and he was always, you know, in his Sam Spade outfit, he was going to do good. You take a movie like...
But he was no Boy Scout.
No, he was no Boy Scout. But he wasn't over the edge either. You know, and now you have a lot of characters that are over the edge, whether they're the protagonist or the antagonist, right? And you've got all of this stuff where everything is total conflict all the time.
Yeah, I just got done watching all three of the Jason Bourne movies over the holidays.
Okay.
That's an example of...
Yeah, it is. It is. And Matt
Damon.
Damon does a great job in those. I was thinking of the fact that if you look at how the bad guys get caught, 40 years ago, the police come and pick them up, right? And they arrest them, and off they go. Today's cop drama, you got to call SWAT out. SWAT gets called out all the time. There's always SWAT. There's always helicopters. There are always guys in army camouflage suits with automatic weapons going into houses, right? And it's all this high-tech stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with solving a crime. It's just visual eye candy.
Much less the psychology of anybody in the picture.
And on top of that, now we've got a whole generation of people believing that CSI, crime scene investigators, can solve a major felony in the matter of minutes, hours, days, you know.
Right.
And so all of it is really, for those of us who have any kind of law enforcement experience or criminal justice experience, all of us that have that experience look at this and just crack up because it's so far from reality, but it's what people come to expect now in mystery literature and in film and in police dramas.
So what they come to expect is the high-tech stuff, the relative lack of character development, the good and evil sort of comic book.
Right.
I mean, it made me think about it has a reflection in politics. When you have a two-party system and you have a set of ideologies that are fundamentalist in nature, where things have to be classified as good or bad and there is no gray area, that's a really different and I think less accurate way of seeing human beings and the human condition than one in which there are all sorts of shades of gray and everybody's kind of psychologically mixed.
What I see going on within the two-party system is that it basically looks at the electorate and figures they're pretty dumb. So what they try to do is propagandize us with buzzwords and phrases that have very little meaning. I don't know how many times a candidate has simply been called wrong by another candidate without any kind of real exposition into the issue. You know, it's just that that's wrong, that's dumb, that's not the right thing, that's not what America wants, that's not good, what's good for the country, that's not what you need. It's all basically, I think, designed to grind away at people giving any thought and attention to real issues. And so the two...
And issues are polarized. It's either on or off, yes or no, black or white on every issue, instead of, for example, environmental issues. There's such a huge range of possibility in how those things are addressed. It's not a yes... It's not yes-no questions.
But if you look at it, the polarization happens during the election, and then it just sort of fades away until the next election cycle, right? Except for the real rabid, you know, true
media.
Believers.
Well, yeah, I mean, but you also have a media who are framing things that way.
Well, and you also have the true believers out there who are going to continue to propagandize as much as they can to get people to agree or at least be sympathetic to their point of view. You know, I'm at the point where I'm thinking a really strong third party in this country would be a very healthy thing. If that could materialize, you know, not just the independents, not independents, but, you know, something that gets us closer to a parliamentary system where people could actually stand up in these hallowed chambers, whether it's a state house or the Capitol, and say, you know, baloney to what you're saying, and here's why I disagree, and have, you know, a kind of dialogue where we could actually hear issues being discussed in greater detail. You know, I was watching a Sunday talk show, and the comment was made by one of the talking heads that, well, these legislators in Washington at 2 o'clock in the morning when they vote a bill up or down haven't even looked at the bill, haven't even read it, don't even know what's in it. They just go in there and vote, you know. I mean, is that really thoughtful democracy? I don't think so.
We're talking to Michael McGarrity, and his latest book is Dead or Alive, and he'll be reading at Garcia Street Books this Saturday, the 10th of January, from 2:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon. Let's go back to the book. This is a book very much about the people and places of New Mexico, as well as good and evil and law enforcement and all of that. And it really shows a real love of and knowledge of the state that you have.
I can't even begin to start writing a book until I know where I'm going to put my characters. I have to have them. I have to have them on the land. I have to fix them in a place. This book was a lot of fun to write because I expanded into the northeast section of the state, up around Springer, Clayton, Raton, that whole area of the short prairie grassland where all those historic ranches still exist.
Right.
And all those ranch people are still there, and they've been there for 3, 4, 5 generations. And so this book has kind of a cowboy feel to it because there's a big, big horseback chase scene that takes them across some of the most historic ranch country in the West all the way into the high mountains bordering the Colorado state line. So that was a heck of a lot of fun to get out there and look at and see and research.
So what do you do? Do you actually get yourself out there and start riding horses around the land?
I don't do a lot of horseback riding anymore. The legs won't hold up the way they used to. But I do spend a lot of time in my all-wheel drive vehicle or walking and looking and talking and meeting and hiking and taking photographs and getting a feel for the place. So I do a lot of that. And so that's how I get out there. And you know, ranch people are really great. I know quite a few ranchers in the state. And so I'll stop by and say, hi, how are you? Do you mind if I poke around a little bit? You know, and they're big fans of my books.
Right.
And so
because there they are in your books.
Yeah, a lot of them really have a great appreciation for you know, the character that I've created in Kearney that has this ranching background. So I use that. And, of course, being an ex-police officer, I also have sort of an entree into law enforcement, too. So I can stop by the Springer Police Department and meet the police chief there and talk to him and go to Raton and spend some time with the officers there and, you know, and get a feel for what they're doing in terms of the job they have. So I do all that kind of research, and I really love it. It's a lot of fun.
One of the things that you have to do, and I think that you're walking sort of a fine line, is using police lingo, but also making it understandable to the reader who doesn't know police lingo. So there's enough of it, like you say, the word 20 comes up, and I guess 20 means location.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of number talk.
Right, right. Well, the CAN codes are standard for police officers to use as a shorthand when they're communicating by radio. And really, anybody can get the 10 codes. I mean, they're not secret.
So everybody knows what 10-4 means, but probably nobody knows what 10-3 or 5 means.
Or 10-98 or, 10-65 or, all those sort of things. But there's a whole series of 10 codes. And then there's basic 10 codes, and then there are codes that other departments will create for themselves for their own internal use. So, I have no compunction about letting people have a little insight into some of the lingo and techniques of what police officers really do. But there's a lot of stuff that I don't talk about that I just assume Mary Charlotte didn't know a damn thing about.
Like what?
Like that. You're not going to catch me.
Well, that's not fair.
I know, but life isn't fair, Mary
Charlotte.
But
I mean, no, hang on. Are you saying that there's some police secrets that you all have and that all of you know and none of the rest of us get to know?
There are police procedures that are usually not discussed with civilians. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, sure.
What about transparency in government? We're paying your salaries.
Not mine anymore.
The rest of them all.
They're not going to tell you. They're not going to tell you what they don't want you to know.
We're talking to Michael McGarrity about his new book, Dead or Alive. And so, it is something, I mean, you've got some pretty good cops in the book. What makes for a good cop? What are the qualities that make a good cop and a not good cop?
Well, first of all, I think there has to be a degree of intelligence. The office, to be a good officer, there are a lot of officers out there that aren't all that bright. That's a reality. That's a fact. They might be good at transporting prisoners. They might be good at serving civil warrants. They might be good at traffic kinds of things. But a really good officer is going to have to be fairly well educated. Not necessarily in terms of having a lot of degrees, but in terms of getting the specialized training that he or she needs to do the job adequately. They have to have a compassion towards people, believe it or not. A lot of times you'll see the officers in police dramas portrayed as hard-nosed, right, and cynical, and seen it all, done it all, nothing gets through the shell, nothing penetrates. But a good officer is going to have a sensibility about other people and a compassion about other people and a real desire to do something good, because police work is good work. It's good work, and it can be very fulfilling work in terms of the satisfaction that you can receive from knowing that you put some bad guys away, that you protected somebody, that you recovered stolen property, that you did any number of good things that helped restore a person's life or gave them a sense of security again. So compassion.
I would think that, I have seen very uncompassionate cops, not in the movies, but in real life, unfortunately. But I was thinking, the job can certainly make you that way, even if you started out with some modicum of compassion.
Well, what you might have seen is somebody with their cop face on. When you get up in the morning and you put the uniform on, and you strap on the sidearm, and you put on the cuffs and the belt, and you go out and get in your unit and drive away, the first thing you do is you put your cop face on. And that's really trained into the officer, because it's really one way the officer establishes his or her authority in a situation, right? But for most police officers, the cop face comes off, too. And it's not there 24/7, and it's not there under every situation with every person, right? I can remember silly little things like stopping somebody for a ticket for speeding. It was a woman, and she started to cry, and I said, "Don't cry, otherwise I'll give you a ticket. I swear I'll give you a ticket if you cry." She's crying, so I gave her a ticket. because you get to the point where you realize that, you know, you're being manipulated too. If you don't hold fast to a certain standard, you know, if she had not cried, I would have given her a verbal warning and walked away. Okay.
As if she could help it. She's probably premenstrual.
Right. Right.
I'm serious.
Okay. All right. So I did a bad thing. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm just saying.
You're assuming. So.
No, I was in exactly that position once. The cops stopped me for going 40 and a 30 on Cerritos at 1 in the morning, and I burst into tears, was completely premenstrual. And the guy, he looked like he would rather have been in a drug dealer shootout than dealing with me at that moment.
Right.
But he didn't give me a ticket.
Well.
But I wasn't manipulating him. I was just at the, you know,
you
I went over the
it.
Edge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway. That's neither here nor there. We're talking about dead or alive.
But finally, we learn something more about you, Mary Charlotte. Finally, something begins to come out. We get closer to you
in terms of our understanding. I am as hormonal as the next lady or gentleman.
So, sensitivity to others, compassion, intelligence, good training, a belief in the system, a belief in right or wrong.
Right, right.
You know? I've worked with good cops and I've worked with bad cops, and What I tried to do in my writing is show both, because I have had officers that were marginal in my books. I've had officers that were vile and evil in my books. But what I wanted to do with the good officers is show that a lot of them are family men. A lot of them are good, solid, respectable people. And that they are as professional as any other profession can be. And I wanted to honor that, and I try to honor that
in my series. I mean, that very much comes through. Yeah. I mean, to the point where we really don't see... I mean, I would think that one of the things that makes a bad cop is somebody who likes to wield power for its own sake.
It can be very seductive.
And we don't see too many of those people in your books.
Well, if you look at Dead or Alive, you'll see that Kearney has an altercation with the Springer police chief.
Right.
Who he thinks... without coming out and really nailing the guy with it, totally screwed up a possible interrogation or interview situation with Larson's twin brother. And so you're left with the feeling that Kearney has his reservations about this officer's capability and capacity. And so those kinds of situations, they happen all the time. And sometimes you can act on them and sometimes you can't. You know, I know some officers that are still serving in the Santa Fe area that I really wouldn't want to have anything to do with personally. You know, and wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. But the majority of them are upstanding, solid, good officers.
We're talking to Michael McGarrity. So you've been writing these books, these Kevin Kearney books, since 1996. How has the whole world of writing, what would you call the genre, thrillers?
Mysteries. They're called mysteries. You know, it's amazing that we have to have labels for everything in this country. You know, you can't just write a book, a novel. It's got to be a crime novel.
I know.
A mystery, a police procedural, a cozy, a whodunit. You know, the list goes on and
or,
on and on.
Or, quote-unquote, literary fiction.
Literary fiction, whatever that is.
But, I mean, these aren't really... There's no mystery in this book.
In this book, there isn't. This is more a thriller. And that was deliberate on my part.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't trying to write a whodunit. And when I do have a book where there's a crime to be solved, I'm not the kind of writer that will tantalize the reader with little clues or take them down the primrose path. I don't care if a reader is 30 pages into the book and finds out who did what to whom. If I tell the story well, if I'm a good storyteller, even if they know how it's going to end, or think they know how it's going to end, I should still be able to keep their attention and still be able to tell them a good story that they'll want to continue to read.
So how do you perceive, what do you know about the audience for your books?
Well, I know that women are totally in love with Kevin Kearney. I mean, I've had to come to the book signings and tell me that. You know, if only Kevin Kearney really existed.
Do they think that you are sort of Kevin Kearney?
Every once in a while they ask me that, and I'll tell them that I'm not as smart, I'm not as tall, I'm not as good looking as Kevin Kearney. You know, so
But close.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. You're a sweetheart. So cops and prosecutors and judges and lawyers are big fans of my books. Cowboys and ranchers love those books. I have a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of email, but I've gotten some sizable number of emails from military personnel.
And of course, Kevin Kearney's wife is a military.
Right. Now, you see, in commercial crime fiction, having a protagonist who's happily married is like the kiss of death for readership, right? But I thought to myself, well, why don't I have this guy marry someone who's going to be gone a long time, like a career military officer?
And who gets post-traumatic stress in Iraq all sorts of things.
Right. And who moves the family to London, in dead or alive, and there's Kearney in London.
That's just because you wanted to take a trip to London.
I took more than one.
to write. Now, it's. I think that's probably one of the wonderful benefits of being a fiction writer is if you can, you get to go to the places you're writing about and research them.
That's
although
right.
Not much of the plot actually takes place actually in London.
Yeah, and I didn't know how much would when I started out. I had no idea whether it'd be a major event taking place there, what would capture Kearney's attention, or whether it would be something where he actually worked a case in Great Britain.
You know, one of the things I want to make sure we get to is that one of the themes of this book is grieving. So you have this remorseless criminal on the one hand, and then you have the victims of their crimes, the survivors, the family and friends of the victims, whose lives are just shattered, and the different ways that they deal with it is something that you really go into.
Yeah, I do. Because it's a great juxtaposition to show that. And there's this wonderful series of scenes that opens up the grieving father of the young rancher who's killed Don Kearney's property, who was Kearney's partner in a horse training and horse breeding operation. And it just was a lot of thought went into trying to show how this guy, this solid Western rancher fella, tries so desperately hard to cope with his enormous sense of loss. And I thought it was a scene that worked remarkably well.
There's a striking paragraph in which you say something like, nobody told him that he needed to have a good long cry or go to therapy or do this or do that.
Right.
And there's this kind of acknowledgement that people really do, if you leave them alone, figure out how to grieve and survive in their own ways.
Right. And yet there were people there lending that man support in very tangible, realistic ways without ever getting to the point of saying you need to have a good cry, you need to see a therapist, you need to let your feelings out. It's not... And that may be hard for Santa Fe to understand.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that. Maybe some segment, but I think, I identified with that. I understood it because there's nothing more annoying than being told how you should deal with your feelings, especially by people who don't know you very well.
Right.
So when you end these books, you always are leaving opportunity for the next book. Do you have the next book in mind when you finish, for example, Dead or Alive?
No, I do actually have two books in mind that I'm.
Both Kevin Kearney's?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to write a book with somebody other than Kevin Kearney as the hero?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Yeah. Will you be back on the show, talking about it?
Well, why not? Why not? But one of the books is a continuation of the series.
Michael McGarrity is the author of 12 Kevin Kearney books, the latest of which is Dead or Alive, and he will be at Garcia Street Books on Saturday, January 10th from 2:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Mary Charlotte, I really believe that next time I have to interview you because, as I said before...
I haven't written a book.
I don't care. Before we ever went on the air, I think you are an absolutely fascinating Santa Fe personality, and Santa Fe needs to learn more about you. So next time you invite me, we're changing places. And I'm interviewing
you. I rescind the invitation.
Too late. It's already gone out over the airways.
Well, Michael McGarrity, I'm turning bright red, but luckily no one in Radio Land can see it. Thank you for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick Appalucci for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Ciao.